Welcome to Ask the Chief Information Officer on Federal News Network. Now your host, Jason Miller.
My guests today are Jason Bruno, the Director of the Office of Strategic Oversight and Performance and the Chief Risk Officer at the Department of Interior's Bureau of Trust Funds Administration. And he is also the President of the Association for Federal Enterprise Risk Management. Jason, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Jason, for having me.
I'm also joined by Kate Silvis, an Enterprise Risk Management Practice Leader at Guidehouse. Kate, welcome back to the program. Great to see you.
It's good to be here.
Today, we are talking about the results of the Affirm survey from 2023. I think there's a lot in that survey, so let's jump right in. Let me start with Jason. Let's talk a little bit about what you found in that survey. What were some of the things that understood about the state of enterprise risk management across government?
You know, one of the things that jumped out for me right away was looking at the highest mean scores for some of our survey responses. What we found was that organizations that incorporated ERM or risk management into the performance plans for their senior executives or SES equivalents were among the highest performing scores in the survey. Along with that were organizations where the ERM program lead reported directly to the agency head or the deputy of the agency. So what that tells me is that where agencies are taking a proactive measures to take ERM seriously, it's working. And those agencies are performing well.
And over the course of this survey, and this is, you'll correct me wrong, the seventh or eighth year in a row, and there's been several, you've been doing this over the last few years. Has that been the one that thing that has stood out year after year, but this year it just seems to really show a big difference?
Yeah, I think so. I think what we're finding is every year, a little bit more incrementally, agencies are incorporating ERM into the very practice of the agency. We're seeing that more dollars are being spent, more resources are being expended on ERM and risk management activities generally. So which means we're seeing more agencies, for example, with five or more FTE equivalent positions, either Fed or contractors, working on ERM. We're seeing that organizations now are reporting that their ERM programs have been established for longer periods of time, so 3 years or more. And we're finding that the ERM program leads generally are spending at least 50% of their time on ERM activities, rather than ERM being one of many activities that the lead is responsible for. And you know, it's having benefits. Those organizations where the ERM spends at least 50% of their time directly on ERM activities are scoring much higher than those who don't.
Kate, let me bring you into the conversation here. When you looked at the survey results and some of the things, are there things that stood out to you as well? You've been doing this. I know you and I have talked at least a couple years now. When you look back, what stood out to you from the survey results?
There's a lot that stood out to me from the survey results, but I want to talk about something that really shows me how this community is moving forward. So if you look at the percentage of programs that are over 3 years old, so 83% of the survey respondents have ERM programs that have been in place for over 3 years. So they've spent a lot of time, you know, putting their foundational aspects in place and have the opportunity now to do some of the harder things with ERM. And those are the types of things like integrating their ERM programs and ERM thought with all of their management processes and having conversations about risk appetite or how much risk they're willing to take or trade off as they're trying to pursue their objectives. And you can see that come across in the numbers. So if you look at the four markers of integration with management processes, the means for those four processes have been going up every year. This year, only one of those processes reverted back a little bit, but not much that it's statistically significant. And so we see that trend of increasing integration across all the management processes. Again, this year, we saw an increase in the number of organizations that have either implemented a risk appetite statement, have used that risk appetite statement, or are considering using a risk appetite statement. And that's a big deal. Last year, we saw a huge increase in risk appetite. And risk appetite, I think, is one of the harder concepts because it is pretty theoretical, right? How much risk am I willing to take? And how do you really quantify that necessarily? It's hard. And so it's that conversation of, okay, team, we have this objective to meet or this strategy that we're trying to achieve. How are we going to do that? Do we need to take some risk? Do we need to maybe bring on a contractor that we've never used before because they're at a bleeding edge of technology that we really need to try in order to meet that? Do we need to take a risk on some of our hiring practices so that we can get more people on board, so that we can deal with backlogs, so that we can achieve this objective? And so I think senior executives are starting to have those conversations in a different way than they did before, and looking at it through that risk lens. And we can see that coming through in those two particular measures in the survey.
The risk appetite's really interesting because I think, as you said, it's, what does that really mean? It's very theoretical. How much risk do we take? Are you able to measure that? Or when you talk to your government clients, what are those conversations like? Do they understand what that means to take on more risk?
Yes, because we put it in context for them. I will say that I have started to change my approach to having conversations about risk appetite from a conversation purely about risk type. So in the past, a lot of risk appetite conversations have been, what's the amount and type of risk that you're willing to take in pursuit of your objectives? How much risk am I willing to take from a financial risk perspective? This is a little harder to, you know, it's a very intellectual, very theoretical exercise. What I've started to talk to my clients about is, okay, you have this strategic objective in your strategic plan. How much risk are you willing to take to achieve that strategy, right? Because the strategy is aligned with the mission. It's aligned with the constituency. It's aligned with a program. What do we have to do in order to achieve the value and the outcomes that those programs, you know, we have determined as an agency are important for our citizens? And so how much risk do we have to take to do that? What are the trade-offs there? If I'm trying to achieve this strategic objective, does that mean that maybe I can't do something else, you know, that we wanted to do, but that's not maybe legislatively mandated? What does that look like from a resource trade-off, whether or not that's dollars or that's people? Or is that we have to create a new technology solution, or we are moving everything to the cloud because it's going to give us, you know, enhanced opportunities? Or perhaps it's a conversation about compliance to say, maybe we were doing 100% compliance before, but that's not a requirement of legislation. And so maybe we take a risk-based approach to compliance. We take a little more risk of compliance on the front end, change some of our compliance requirements on the back end. We give ourselves some capacity to allow us to achieve an objective in a different way. You using some of those resources, I can move them. Those are conversations around that strategic objective, around that risk appetite. What am I willing to take on that really hits at the business and the mission that the senior executives, like, they can dig their teeth into those because it makes sense and it's a real decision-making conversation, where the conversation about, you know, how much financial risk or how much compliance risk, you know, isn't at that decision-making point for them.
Jason, similar question to you, and you can talk if you're comfortable talking about it personally from your role with the Department of Interior's Bureau of Trust Funds Administration, more broadly from your role as a firm president. Do you feel like that risk appetite discussion is much different today than it has been, you know, a year ago, 5 years ago?
So I do. One of the things, and Kate touched on this in her response, but one of the things that surprised me most about the survey was what seemed to me a huge uptick in the number of organizations that have defined risk appetite statement. This was the highest response rate since we started this question in 2017. So it's just wonderful to know that organizations, you know, across the government are putting a higher focus on the risk appetite statements. There's a definite increase in the number of respondents who indicated the risk appetite statements are communicated throughout the organizations and integrated into the strategy session and decision-making. More than 90% of the respondents who responded to the survey indicated that their risk appetite statement has been updated within the last 3 years. And over 60% of the respondents indicated that their ERM programs plan to increase their focus on risk appetite over the next 12 months, say. So what we're seeing across the board is more focused on incorporating risk appetite into the ERM program as a whole. And what that shows is a maturation of ERM programs and how seriously people take it. So when folks start out, you know, it's easy to do the easy stuff, right? So, you know, ERM program professionals can get stuck into doing the simple things. They want to interview the executives. They want to send out surveys. They want to identify risks, and they want to develop a risk profile or a risk register. Now, those are all, you know, basic things that absolutely need to happen as programs mature. But the harder stuff is engaging the executives and managers and employees of the organization about what we really mean by drilling down to the risk appetite and thinking about the real world consequences of the uncertainties that organizations face and what the organizations want to do to treat those uncertainties. In risk terms, we're talking about mitigation strategies for risks. So it's good to see that it appears that more agencies are getting more mature in their ERM programs. And, you know, you asked me about my organization. We formalized our ERM program probably about 5 or 6 years ago with a developing of risk governance structure, a senior risk council, and a senior assessment team that are there to assess risks. As we have matured, we have done what I've just said. We've gone from just having a risk register that lists all the risks and a risk profile that talks about the treatments or the mitigations of the risk, but really incorporating the concepts of what to do about those real world risks with the conversation about risk appetite.
Jason, Kate, on that note, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. My guests today are Jason Bruno, the Director of the Office of Strategic Oversight and Performance and Chief Risk Officer for the Department of the Interior's Bureau of Trust Funds Administration and the President of the Association for Federal Enterprise Risk Management, and Kate Silvis, an Enterprise Risk Management Practice Leader at Guidehouse. I'm Jason Miller, and you're listening to a special edition of Ask the CIO on Federal News Network. Welcome back. You're listening to a special edition of Ask the CIO on Federal News Network. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guests today are Jason Bruno, the Director of the Office of Strategic Oversight and Performance and Chief Risk Officer for the Department of the Interior's Bureau of Trust Funds Administration and the President of the Association for Federal Enterprise Risk Management, and Kate Silvis, an Enterprise Risk Management Practice Leader at Guidehouse. And just sticking with the kind of your experience with the Department of Interior, when you have incorporated these concepts and really talked about real world risks, have you seen kind of that appetite change as well? I mean, again, without maybe getting into too many specifics, 10 years ago, you would have never have done this. But now, because you understand the risks and the risk register and risk profiles in a different way, that's a step. There's a step that maybe folks would take now that previously they wouldn't.
Sure. So when our organization went through the process every year of identifying risks and developing them into a profile and ranking them, there's oftentimes discussion towards the the end of the fiscal year as everything's identified, and we bring it up to our senior leaders about what to do with the risks. And our leader of the organization has to decide how to allocate, you know, budget towards the end of the year for the following years or the following 2 years or 3 years. You know, we're always on a bit of a delayed budget cycle. And what we've started to do is incorporated the top risks into our strategic planning process and our project management process. We have a lead for strategic planning and project management, and that lead works directly with our lead for ERM in helping the director of our bureau plan out strategies, which real world dollars. How are we going to incorporate our contracting dollars, our project management dollars towards the various activities and the needs of the organization? So for example, 1 year, one of our highest risks identified that we had not updated our accounting procedures and our financial management procedures for over 5, 7, 8, 9 years. And our senior managers identified that as a risk and uncertainty that they were concerned about. And that rose to the top of the list. And our bureau director sat with his senior managers and the CRO, me at the time, and decided to engage in a project, pretty exhaustive, to look at every single procedure, our accounting procedure of our organization, and not quite re-engineer, but redocument, revise, and rewrite all procedures. It's been now a 2.5 year project that we're finishing up. And we revised probably about 5,000 pages of DOPs, SOPs, and employee handbooks. I don't think that ever would have happened as easily or efficiently if we didn't have an ERM process to marshal that through, to identify it and to stick to it. Because it's one thing for a leader to raise their hand and say, hey, I'm a little worried about this thing. But if they don't have the metrics to back it up, if they don't have the history and any other kind of calculations about what that risk really is and what the consequences of that risk emerging would happen, really helps bolster concrete action by an organization.
Jason, that's actually a really great example. This is not sexy to redocument, rewrite, update financial management processes,
exactly,
but they matter a whole lot, right? I mean, every agency is looking to get auditability. Most have, except for our friends in the Defense Department. But it's easily GAO or the IG could come in and slap a wrist if you don't have these updated policies. But it's more than just auditability. It's understanding where the money is going, how you're spending it, how you're managing it. So I think that's a terrific example. And I'll throw it over to Kate. Kate, any examples that stand out to you from clients that you've worked with very similarly that shows that this risk appetite, this understanding of ERM is really coming through in a more meaningful way than just saying, hey, look, we do it.
We worked with an organization when they were standing up. So it was new legislation and they were standing up their compliance program. We sat down and met with the senior leadership team and talked through what their objectives were around compliance, and then went through a risk appetite exercise. So according to the objectives of the program, what was their appetite for risk in each measure and metric around compliance? We then took that conversation and translated it to, what does that mean for operations? So how does this translate to the number of people that you would have, the depth of compliance reviews that you would do, whether or not you would do those compliance reviews from a preventative perspective or from a detective perspective? And they really used that risk appetite exercise and the connection to the operation of the program to then develop and design how they were going to run the compliance program. So it was built around their appetite. And they had the benefit of being able to start that right from scratch with a conversation about appetite, where most programs don't have that benefit.
All right. That's, again, another good example to really show the kind of what the changes are happening. I'm going to shift over to when you look at the survey, is there any findings that disappointed you? Kate, I'll start with you on that one. Anything that you said, I can't believe this is still 22% or this is still struggling in some way.
I'm going to change the word disappointing to say that I think that there are two areas for me where I think we can still be more effective. I'm going to start with the areas of barriers to ERM and then top improvements. And the two items that come up here year in and year out are bridging silos and executive buy-in. And what that means to me is that as a community, we haven't quite hit it right as far as the communication of the value to our senior leaders. We haven't quite hit it right on consensus building tools and techniques so that we can, you know, build that, those bridging of silos. I think that there are ways that we can work with different skill domains to do a better job of building that kind of almost marketing and communications for better executive buy-in and better bridging of silos. So that one was one to me that I hope someday we'll find the answer to. The second one that I do talk about a lot is the difference between the perception of risk and what management is doing about risk. And there are five risk types that always come up every year in the survey where the perception of risk is much lower than what management is doing about those risks. And that mismatch is an opportunity for organizations to look and say, am I over-controlling this? Do these activities that we're taking, are they more than my residual risk appetite actually is for these particular risk types? If I look at these processes, can I create capacity somewhere else while still maintaining the risk profile that I need to maintain, for OIG or for GAO? Or to be a good steward of taxpayer dollars for this program. I think those are questions that we need to ask ourselves and not just say business process as usual, particularly as we look at budget constraints that are going to become more and more prevalent, I believe. We have to look at programs and say, is there a way that we can maintain this program with the same risk profile, or should my risk profile for this program be different so that I can release capacity, move resources to another area that needs them so that our agencies can really build resilience in and be able to function in the event of more budget cuts, which I do think is a possibility to come. And so these five risk areas, you know, are the start of that. And I think building the capability to look at our processes from that perspective is something that will benefit us as a community down the line.
So, Kate, I got to ask you, of course, what are some of those five risk types that always come up? I'm sure you know them off the top of your head.
Sure. Yeah. They're business continuity, financial risk, compliance, reporting, and fraud.
And you get a sense those are the five that, I mean, those are the easy to understand. Those are things that kind of every program faces. Is that why these are the popular, is not the right word, but the most common ones?
My hypothesis is because they're all connected to financial reporting. And so for years under, you know, ICAFR, we have to have controls in place around those things. And so the controls have been built up. The controls have been tested around those particular risk types. And so therefore, they're just in place. And they've never really been looked at to say, have we over-controlled this? You know, we just had to put them in place because they're ICAFR controls. And that's my hypothesis on why those five continuously show up.
Jason, Kate, on that note, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. My guests today are Jason Bruno, the Director of the Office of Strategic Oversight and Performance and Chief Risk Officer for the Department of the Interior's Bureau of Trust Funds Administration, and the President of the Association for Federal Enterprise Risk Management, and Kate Silvis, an Enterprise Risk Management Practice Leader at Guidehouse. I'm Jason Miller, and you're listening to a special edition of Ask the CIO on Federal News Network. Welcome back. You're listening to a special edition of Ask the CIO on Federal News Network. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guests today are Jason Bruno, the Director of the Office of Strategic Oversight and Performance and Chief Risk Officer for the Department of the Interior's Bureau of Trust Funds Administration and the President of the Association for Federal Enterprise Risk Management, and Kate Silvis, an Enterprise Risk Management Practice Leader at Guidehouse. Jason, appreciated Kate changing the wording from disappointing to areas for improvement. The silos piece, you know, one of the things a firm does is you try to bridge those silos by bringing chief risk officers and others together. Do you feel like that the silo bridging better, but and the executive buy-in is better, but that's still a common area that, that agencies struggle with?
Yeah, so I think I could answer, respond to your question and also your question for Kate about the quote, disappointing aspect. And again, I like her rewording it to areas of improvement. So the numbers that stuck out to me, I think, also respond to your question about the problem with siloing within an organization. So one of the things that I noticed right away was that only about 40% or so of the respondents indicated that an organization's ERM program leader reported either to the agency head or deputy of the agency. So I'd like to see that number grow precisely because of the siloing problem, right? So if the CRO, chief risk officer, or whatever the title might be, but the person in charge of ERM, if they're not reporting to the top, it's harder to take a top-down approach across the silos. So, you know, you have a situation where about 17% are folks who are or lead the ERM programs report to the COO, about 23% or so report to the CFO, and about 23% or so report to someone else within the organization who's not the agency head or deputy. And what happens when they're not reporting to the top is it just makes it harder to break those silos because, you know, the ERM person themselves are embedded in one of the organizational units. And, you know, the whole idea of ERM is breaking out of the organizational units. My experience, my colleagues, coworkers, and peers who I've talked to through the years, the ones who are reporting to either the, you know, the principal deputy or the actual bureau director or the agency head or whatever their title might be, just find it easier to get that buy-in across the board and actually to work within the various parts of the organization to help. Because I have to say, breaking down the silos is absolutely one of the most important early steps for every risk officer within an organization. And anyone who wants to incorporate ERM throughout the organization. One of the things, you know, I hear a lot about complaints with organizations that don't have, you know, robust ERM programs is, oh, we got to break out of our silos. We're too siloed. And that's a, you know, recurring theme year after year after year. I do think having that robust ERM program helps with that siloing effect because you have someone who is not within an operations office. So that's one part of it. The other thing I'd like to see a little bit better in our responses in the ensuing years is that about 60% of respondents indicated that their organization had some sort of formal chief risk officer. Many of them have ERM programs of some sort, but only about 60 have that formal designation. I would like to see that number increase in the coming years. It's hard, especially for smaller agencies. Through my work at a firm, I get a lot of calls from people and agencies who are saying, I'd like to get an ERM program off the ground. I'd like to start, do you have some recommendations for me? Can you walk through how you created your organization? And I mean, I just talked to someone who 3 or 4 weeks ago that their agency or office that they're trying to get off the ERM off the ground is only about 30 feds. Really hard to have a dedicated ERM or CRO professional who only does ERM when your entire office is only 30 people. So it in situations like that, one of the things about ERM that I really like is the ability of risk leaders to change things up on the fly. One, I'm getting a little bit away from your question, but one of the things that I tell the risk management analysts under me in my office is that going by the book is fine and it's a great start, but you've got to break away from the by the book implementation of ERM, because some organizations have 30,000 people. The CRO for the Department of Interior, our organization has tens of thousands of employees. My organization, BTFA within Interior, only has about 400 employees. So the way I perform risk management, it is quite different from the way the CRO for the Department of Interior performs risk management. And just knowing that is really important. I went a little bit afar from the original question, but I hope that that gives you what you need.
No, absolutely. I think it's really a key point that having a title, we have CXOs all over the place. We have new chief AI officers. There's some chief customer experience officer. There's a bill in Congress asking for that. Having a chief risk officer, it matters because it's the proverbial seat at the table. One of the things that stood out, obviously, is that increase in the number of chief risk officers. It's hard to say why that happened, maybe, but there's definitely been a positive sign. Jason, talk a little bit about that. What, when you talk to the community, when you talk to your colleagues, do they want that title of CRO? Do they see the value of that title of CRO? Or are they saying, hey, I'm the director of enterprise risk management, that's fine, or I'm the grand poobah of enterprise risk management? Is that having that CRO title mattering more and more?
The short answer is yes, it does matter. It's hard to put into words. And, you know, one of the things that we might talk about is how we might change our survey questions in the coming years. And I'd like to find a way to ask folks in the community about the importance of those titles. It'd be nice to have some sort of formal response so we can have some data. Because right now I'm going on anecdotally what I'm hearing from my peers, but it'd be great to have a bigger sample set. But anecdotally, it's tough to say this, but titles matter. Where you sit in an organization matters. And so, you know, everybody knows generally what a CFO does. Everybody knows what a CIO does and a COO does. And one of the reasons everybody knows that is because those things have been in effect for years or decades now. I would like to see that in 10 years from now, everybody, including people who are not risk management professionals, know what a CRO does. And so an important part of that general understanding and acceptance among even non-risk professionals is starting with the actual position or title of chief risk officer, so more people see it and more people see what they're doing.
I agree with you that the title matters, and I think folks are starting to come around to that in the sense of understanding, okay, if we have someone who has that title, then they lead this effort. Jason, Kate, on that note, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. My guests today are Jason Bruno, the Director of the Office of Strategic Oversight and Performance and Chief Risk Officer for the Department of the Interior's Bureau of Trust Funds Administration and the President of the Association for Federal Enterprise Risk Management, and Kate Silvis, an Enterprise Risk Management Practice Leader at Guidehouse. I'm Jason Miller, and you're listening to a special edition of Ask the CIO on Federal News Network. Welcome back. You're listening to a special edition of Ask the CIO on Federal News Network. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guests today are Jason Bruno, the director of the Office of Strategic Oversight and Performance and chief risk officer for the Department of the Interior's Bureau of Trust Funds Administration, and the president of the Association for Federal Enterprise Risk Management, and Kate Silvis, an enterprise risk management practice leader at Guidehouse. One of the big changes from the survey, or one of the big results that I saw, was around using ERM to drive decision-making. We talked about risk appetite. We talked about compliance activities a little bit. From your perspective of what you saw in the survey, and maybe even just more broadly, do you get the sense that agencies are seeing that ERM is driving more decisions for a lot of agencies?
I think the agencies that have ERM that is useful, so that are not using it as a check the box exercise, are in fact using ERM to help drive decisions, where they are looking at what really is either threatening our ability to achieve our objectives, or what kind of are themes across those multiple different silos that we have to come together and work on collectively, that have embedded, and this isn't a lot of agencies, but that have embedded enterprise risk management into both the strategic planning and the budget formulation and the budget execution process, that are using risk to drive those decisions. Like, what is one of your business unit risks that you need funding for, you need investment for? That conversation goes into your budget request. I am trying to mitigate a key risk. I'm trying to mitigate an enterprise risk, and we need budget for it. And that is actually as part of their process. Organizations that are using ERM in that way get better outcomes from a performance perspective. And I do think that agencies that are using ERM kind of in that way to really understand their risks and to make decisions, and not just, oh, we have to have a risk list for the sake of having a risk list, do see value from it from a decision-making perspective.
And hopefully, as with anything, decisions are better. They're based in fact. They're based in data. And then they're also, drive home the point, based on risk. Jason, just want to ask about this. When you look at the results of the survey, how is this driving some of your priorities for a firm in 2024 and beyond?
We have a couple of big priorities with a firm that we believe is in alignment with the general results of the survey. So one of the biggest things that we'd like to see at a firm, and it's going to be one of my big priorities, I have two or three priorities, right? So they are growing the membership of a firm. And because, you know, one of the things that I think about trade associations and associations generally and why people join them. And a big reason why people are joining associations are for their ability to network, meet other people and other professionals in the industry, and to be able to have a good, robust exchange of ideas between them. What are they doing and how are they doing them? Because oftentimes people, and, you know, one of the things you'll see in the survey, you know, the risk management professionals sometimes can be a bit of an island in their organization, right? So if you look at the results of the survey, there is a substantial number of people where, or respondents that say that the number of ERM professionals is less than five within their organization. And frankly, there are a number where they're the only members. So there's only one ERM professional in their organization. And so it's really hard to go to your colleagues or peers or friends to talk about ideas for improvement in their agency if they don't have access to those peers, that community of practice. So one of the things that we're doing from this year is really trying to grow our community of practice, both formal and informal, within the federal community. I'd like to grow the membership of a firm. And I'd also like to take a look at our, you know, sponsorship activities, including some of, you know, the big corporate sponsors that we have who are really involved in the ERM process and the ERM landscape, and find better ways to involve them in the, you know, federal ERM professionals' day-to-day work. So not just the annual summit at the end of the year where we bring everybody together. So we're talking about putting together more lunch and learns, happy hours, presentations and discussions throughout the year. And that way, folks won't have to feel like so much of an island alone when they're, you know, going through really, really tough decision-making processes, how to bring their program to the next level. Because, you know, frankly, a lot of agencies don't have the funding necessarily to bring in consultants. Consultants are wonderful, but in these days of tightening budgets, it's harder and harder to get the money to be able to use their expertise. I, you know, highly recommend it when you can, but when we can't, we have to be able to rely on other friends and other for that wise counsel.
All right, Kate, you heard him say consultants are great. So now you have that on record, and now you can play that over in a loop as your clients tell you. In the last couple minutes we have together, Kate, what's your big takeaway from the survey? What do you hope that folks in industry can learn about the state of risk management across the government?
From my perspective, as I look at it, you know, as a consultant, you know, what I talked about earlier around bridging silos and that executive buy-in as areas that just keep showing up, you know, I feel like it's incumbent upon me as a contractor for a lot of federal agencies to do a better job of helping to bridge those gaps, to create some of the materials that can be used to have those value conversations and to engage in the other domains like marketing, communications, and to really be able to help in that way. And Tom Brandt, when he was a firm president, made a statement that I loved and hated at the same time, right? As a contractor, he said, if the government paid for it once, we should all benefit from it, and created the resources page on for a firm so that we can share that information. And so I do think that that is a benefit, as Jason mentioned, and that we should try and work ourselves out of a job in that way.
All right. There's a lot more to talk about. Unfortunately, we are out of time for today. So let me thank my guests. Jason Bruno is the director of the Office of Strategic Oversight and Performance and the chief risk officer at the Department of the Interior's Bureau of Trust Funds Administration. He's also the president of the Association for Federal Enterprise Risk Management. Jason, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Kate Silvis is an enterprise risk management practice leader at Guidehouse. Kate, always a pleasure to catch up with you as well.
Great to be here.
I'm Jason Miller, and you've been listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Network.
You've been listening to Ask the Chief Information Officer on Federal News Network. Tune in Thursday mornings at 10 or subscribe to this show on iTunes or Podcast One.